addictive properties of caffeine transform the field, helping us to see coffee less as a food than as a drug, and led to the listing of caffeine withdrawal syndrome in the most recent edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM-5. By the time Griffiths turned 50 in 1994, he was a scientist at the top of his game and his field. But that year, Griffiths' career took an unexpected turn, the result of two serendipitous introductions. The first came when a friend introduced him to Siddha Yoga. Despite his behaviorist orientation as a scientist, Griffiths had always been interested in what philosophers call phenomenology, the subjective experience of consciousness. He had tried meditation as a graduate student, but found that, quote, he couldn't sit still without going stark raving mad. 3 minutes felt like 3 hours. But when he tried it again in 1994, something opened up for me. He started meditating regularly, going on retreats, and working his way through a variety of Eastern spiritual traditions. He found himself drawn, quote, deeper and deeper into this mystery. Somewhere along the way, Griffiths had what he modestly describes as, quote, a funny kind of awakening, a mystical experience. I was surprised when Griffiths mentioned this during our first meeting in his office, so I hadn't followed up. But even after I had gotten to know him a little better, Griffiths was still reluctant to say much more about exactly what happened. And as someone who had never had such an experience, I had trouble gaining any traction with the idea whatsoever. All he would tell me is that the experience, which took place in his meditation practice, acquainted him with, quote, something way, way beyond a material worldview that I can't really talk to my colleagues about, because it involves metaphors or assumptions that I'm really uncomfortable with as a scientist. In time, what he was learning about, quote, the mystery of consciousness and existence in his meditation practice came to seem more compelling to him than his science. He began to feel somewhat alienated. None of the people I was close to had any interest in entertaining those questions, which fell into the general category of the spiritual and religious people I just didn't get. Here I am, a full professor, publishing like crazy, running off to important meetings, and thinking I was a fraud. He began to lose interest in the research that had organized his whole adult life. I could study a new sedative hypnotic, learn something new about brain receptors, be on another FDA panel, go to another conference, but so what? I was more emotionally and intellectually curious about where this other path might lead. My drug research began to seem vacuous. I was going through the motions at work, much more interested in going home in the evening to meditate. The only way he could motivate himself to continue writing grants was to think of it as a service project for his graduate students and postdocs. In the case of his caffeine research, Griffiths had been able to take his curiosity about a dimension of his own experience, why did he feel compelled to drink coffee every day, and turn it into a productive line of scientific inquiry. But he could see no way to do that with his deepening curiosity about the dimensions of consciousness that meditation had opened up to him. He said, "It never occurred to me that there was any way to study it scientifically." Stymied and bored, Griffiths began to entertain thoughts of quitting science and going off to an ashram in India. It was around this time that Bob Schuster, an old friend and colleague who had recently retired as head of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, phoned Griffiths to suggest he talk to a young man he had recently met at Esalen named Bob Jesse. Jesse had organized a small gathering of researchers, therapists, and religious scholars at the legendary Big Sur Retreat Center to discuss the spiritual and therapeutic potential of psychedelic drugs and how they might be rehabilitated. Jesse himself was neither a medical professional nor a scientist. He was a computer engineer, a vice president of business development at Oracle, who had made it his mission to revive the science of psychedelics, but as a tool not so much of medicine as of spiritual development. Griffiths had told Schuster a little about his spiritual practice and confided in him his growing discontent with conventional drug research. "You should talk to this guy," Schuster told him. "They have some interesting ideas about working with entheogens," he said. "You might have something in common." When the history of second-wave psychedelic research is written, Bob Jesse will be seen as one of a pair of scientific outsiders in America amateurs really, and brilliant eccentrics who worked tirelessly, often behind the scenes, to get it off the ground. Both found their vocation in the wake of transformative psychedelic experiences that convinced them that these substances had the potential to heal not only individuals, but humankind as a whole, and that the best path to their rehabilitation was by way of credible scientific research. In many cases, these untrained researchers dreamed up the experiments first and then found and funded the scientists to conduct them. Often you will find their names on the papers, usually in the last position. Of the two, Rick Doblin has been at it longer and is by far the more well-known. Doblin founded the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS, all the way back in the dark days of 1986, the year after MDMA was made illegal, and a time when most wiser heads were convinced that restarting research into psychedelics was a cause beyond hopeless. Doblin, born in 1953, is a great shaggy dog with a bone. He has been lobbying to change the government's mind about psychedelics since shortly after graduating from New College in Florida in 1987. After experimenting with LSD as an undergraduate and later with MDMA, Doblin decided his calling in life was to become a psychedelic therapist. But after the banning of MDMA in 1985, that dream became unachievable without a change in federal laws and regulations. So he decided he'd better first get a doctorate in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. There, he mastered the intricacies of the FDA's drug approval process, and in his dissertation plotted the laborious path to official acceptance that psilocybin and MDMA are now following. Doblin is disarmingly, perhaps helplessly, candid, happy to talk openly to a reporter about his formative psychedelic experiences as well as political strategy and tactics. Like Timothy Leary, Doblin is the happiest of warriors, never not smiling, and exhibiting a degree of enthusiasm for the work you wouldn't expect from a man who has been knocking his head against the same wall for his entire adult life. Doblin works out of a somewhat Dickensian office tucked into the attic of his rambling colonial in Belmont, Massachusetts, at a desk stacked to the ceiling with precarious piles of manuscripts, journal articles, photographs, and memorabilia reaching back more than 40 years. Some of the memorabilia commemorates the time early in his career when Doblin decided the best way to end sectarian strife would be to mail a group of the world's spiritual leaders tablets of MDMA, a drug famous for its ability to break down barriers between people and kindle empathy. Around the same time, he arranged to have 1,000 doses of MDMA sent to people in the Soviet military who were working on arms control negotiations with President Reagan. For Doblin, winning FDA approval for the medical use of psychedelics, which he believes is now in view for both MDMA and psilocybin, is a means to a more ambitious and still more controversial end. The incorporation of psychedelics into American society and culture, not just medicine. This, of course, is the same winning strategy followed by the campaign to decriminalize marijuana, in which promoting the medical uses of cannabis changed the drug's image, leading to a more general public acceptance. Not surprisingly, this sort of talk rankles more cautious heads in the community, Bob Jesse among them, but Rick Doblin is not one to soft-pedal his agenda or to even think about taking an interview off the record. This gets him a lot of press. How much it helps the cause is debatable. But there is no question that, especially in the last several years, Doblin has succeeded in getting important research approved and funded, especially in the case of MDMA, which has long been MAPS' main focus. MAPS has sponsored several small clinical trials that have demonstrated MDMA's value in treating post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Doblin defines psychedelics generously so as to include MDMA and even cannabis, even though their mechanisms of action in the brain are very different from that of the classical psychedelics. But beyond helping those suffering with PTSD and other indications, MAPS is sponsoring a clinical study at UCLA that involves treating autistic adults with MDMA, Doblin believes fervently in the power of psychedelics to improve humankind by disclosing a spiritual dimension of consciousness we all share, regardless of our religious beliefs or lack thereof. Mysticism, he likes to say, is the antidote to fundamentalism. Compared with Rick Doblin, Bob Jesse is a monk. There is nothing shaggy or uncareful about him. Taut, press-shy, and disposed to choose his words with a pair of tweezers, Jesse, now in his 50s, prefers to do his work out of public view and preferably from the one-room cabin where he lives by himself in the rugged hills north of San Francisco, off the grid except for a fast internet connection. Bob Jesse is like the puppeteer, Catherine McLean told me. McLean is a psychologist who worked in Roland Griffith's lab from 2009 until 2013. He's the visionary guy working behind the scenes. Following Jesse's meticulous directions, I drove north from the Bay Area, eventually winding up at the end of a narrow dirt road in a county he asked me not to name. I parked at a trailhead and made my way past the no trespassing signs, following a path up a hill that brought me to his picturesque mountaintop camp. I felt as if I were going to visit the wizard. The ship-shaped little cabin is tight for two, so Jesse has set out among the fir trees and boulders some comfortable sofas, chairs, and tables. He's also built an outdoor kitchen, and on a shelf of rock commanding a spectacular view of the mountains, an outdoor shower, giving the camp the feeling of a house turned inside out. We spent the better part of an early spring day outdoors in his living room, sipping herbal tea and discussing his notably quieter campaign to restore psychedelics to respectability, a master plan in which Roland Griffiths plays a central role. "I'm a little camera shy," he began, "so please, no pictures or recordings of any kind." Jesse is a slender, compact fellow with a squarish head of closely cropped gray hair and rimless rectangular glasses that are unostentatiously stylish. Jesse seldom smiles and has some of the stiffness I associate with engineers, though occasionally he'll surprise you with a flash of emotion he will immediately then caption. You may have noticed that thinking about that subject made my eyes get a little watery. Let me explain why. Not only does he choose his own words with great care, but he insists that you do too. So, for example, when I carelessly deployed the term recreational use, he stopped me in mid-sentence. Maybe we need to re-examine that term. Typically, it is used to trivialize an experience. But why? In its literal meaning, the word recreation implies something decidedly non-trivial. There is much more to be said, but let's bookmark this topic for another time. Please, go on. My notes showed that Jesse took our first conversation on and off the record half a dozen times. Jesse grew up outside Baltimore and went to Johns Hopkins, where he studied computer science and electrical engineering. For several years in his 20s, he worked for Bell Labs, commuting weekly from Baltimore to New Jersey. During this period, he came out of the closet and persuaded management to recognize the company's first gay and lesbian employee group. At the time, AT&T, the parent company, employed some 300,000 people. Later, he persuaded AT&T management to fly a rainbow flag over headquarters during Gay Pride Week and send a delegation to march in the parade. This achievement formed Bob Jesse's political education, impressing on him the value of working behind the scenes without making a lot of noise or demanding credit. Jesse moved to Oracle in the Bay Area in 1990, becoming employee number 8,766. Not one of the first, but early enough to have acquired a chunk of stock in the company. It wasn't long before Oracle fielded its own contingent in San Francisco's Gay Pride Parade, and after Jesse's gentle prodding of senior management, Oracle became one of the first Fortune 500 companies to offer benefits to the same-sex partners of its employees. Jesse's curiosity about psychedelics was first piqued during a drug education unit in his high school science class. This particular class of drugs was neither physically nor psychologically addictive, he was told, correctly. His teacher went on to describe the drug's effects, including shifts in consciousness and visual perception that Jesse found intriguing. "I could sense that there was even more here than they were telling us," he recalled, "so I made a mental note." But he would not be ready to see for himself what psychedelics were all about until much later. Why? He answered in the third person. A closeted gay kid might be afraid of what might come out if he let his guard down. In his 20s, while working at Bell Labs, Jesse fell in with a group of friends in Baltimore who decided, in a most deliberate way, to experiment with psychedelics. Someone would always remain, quote, close to ground level in case anyone needed help or the doorbell rang, and doses escalated gradually. It was during one of these Saturday afternoon experiments in an apartment in Baltimore that Jesse, 25 years old and having ingested a high dose of LSD, had a powerful non-dual experience that would prove transformative. I asked him to describe it, and after some hemming and hawing, I hope you'll bracket what is sensitive, he gingerly proceeded to tell the story. I was lying on my back underneath a ficus tree, he recalls. I knew it was going to be a strong experience, and the point came where the little I still was just started slipping away. I lost all awareness of being on the floor in an apartment in Baltimore. I couldn't tell if my eyes were opened or closed. What opened up before me was, for lack of a better word, a space, but not our ordinary concept of space, just the pure awareness of a realm without form and void of content. And into that realm came a celestial entity, which was the emergence of the physical world. It was like the Big Bang, but without the boom or the blinding light. It was the birth of the physical universe. In one sense, it was dramatic, maybe the most important thing that had ever occurred in the history of the world, yet it just sort of happened. I asked him where he was in all this. I was a diffusely located observer. I was coextensive with this emergence. Here I let him know he was losing me. Long pause. I'm hesitating because the words are an awkward fit. Words seem too constraining. Ineffability is, of course, a hallmark of the mystical experience. The awareness transcends any particular sensory modality, he explained, unhelpfully. Was it scary? There was no terror, only fascination and awe. Pause. Maybe a little fear. From here on, Jesse watched, or whatever you call it, the birth of everything in the unfolding of an epic sequence, beginning with the appearance of cosmic dust, leading to the creation of the stars and then the solar systems, followed by the emergence of life, and from there the arrival of what we call humans, then the acquisition of language and the unfolding of awareness, all the way up to oneself, here in this room, surrounded by my friends. I had come all the way back to right where I was. How much clock time had elapsed, I had no idea. What stands out most for me is the quality of the awareness I experienced, something entirely distinct from what I've come to regard as Bob. How does this expanded awareness fit into the scope of things? To the extent I regard the experience as veridical, and about that I'm still not sure, it tells me that consciousness is primary to the physical universe. In fact, it precedes it. Did he now believe consciousness exists outside the brain? He's not certain. But to go from being very sure that the opposite is true, that consciousness is the product of our gray matter, to be unsure is an immense shift. I asked him if he agreed with something I'd read the Dalai Lama had said, that the idea that brains create consciousness, an idea accepted without question by most scientists, is, quote, a metaphysical assumption, not a scientific fact. Bingo, Jesse said. And for someone with my orientation, agnostic, enamored of science, that changes everything. Here's what I don't get about an experience like Bob Jesse's. Why in the world would you ever credit it at all? I didn't understand why you wouldn't simply file it under interesting dream or drug-induced fantasy. But along with the feeling of ineffability, the conviction that some profound objective truth has been disclosed to you is a hallmark of the mystical experience, regardless of whether it has been occasioned by a drug, meditation, fasting, flagellation, or sensory deprivation. William James gave a name to this conviction, the noetic quality. People feel they have been let in on a deep secret of the universe, and they cannot be shaken from that conviction. As James wrote, dreams cannot stand this test. No doubt, this is why some of the people who have had such an experience go on to found religions, changing the course of history or, in a great many more cases, the course of their own lives. No doubt is the key. I can think of a couple of ways to account for such a phenomenon, neither entirely satisfying. The most straightforward and yet hardest to accept explanation is that it's simply true. The altered state of consciousness has opened the person up to a truth that the rest of us, imprisoned in ordinary waking consciousness, simply cannot see. Science has trouble with this interpretation, however, because whatever the perception is, it can't be verified by its customary tools. It's an anecdotal report, in effect, and so has no value. science has little interest in and tolerance for the testimony of the individual. In this, it is, curiously, much like an organized religion, which has a big problem crediting direct revelation too. But it's worth pointing out that there are cases where science has no choice but to rely on individual testimony, as in the study of subjective consciousness, which is inaccessible to our scientific tools and so can only be described by the person experiencing it. Here, phenomenology is the all-important data. However, this is not the case when ascertaining truths about the world outside our heads. The problem with crediting mystical experiences is precisely that they often seem to erase the distinction between inside and outside, in the way that Bob Jesse's diffuse awareness seemed to be his, but also to exist outside him. This points to the second possible explanation for the noetic sense. When our sense of a subjective I disintegrates, as it often does in a high-dose psychedelic experience, as well as in meditation by experienced meditators, it becomes impossible to distinguish between what is subjectively and objectively true. What's left to do the doubting, if not your I? In the years following that first powerful psychedelic journey, Bob Jesse had a series of other experiences that shifted the course of his life. Living in San Francisco in the early 1990s, he got involved in the rave scene and discovered that the collective effervescence of the best all-night dance parties, with or without psychedelic materials, could also dissolve the subject-object duality and open up new spiritual vistas. He began to explore various spiritual traditions, from Buddhism to Quakerism to meditation, and found his priorities in life gradually shifting. It began to occur to me that spending time in this area might actually be far more important and far more fulfilling than what I had been doing as a computer engineer. While on a sabbatical from Oracle, he would leave for good in 1995, Jesse set up a nonprofit called the Council on Spiritual Practices, or CSP, with the aim of, quote, making direct experience of the sacred more available to more people. The website downplays the organization's interest in promoting entheogens, Bob Jesse's preferred term for psychedelics, but does describe its mission in suggestive terms, to, quote, identify and develop approaches to primary religious experience that can be used safely and effectively. The website, csp.org, offers an excellent bibliography of psychedelic research and regular updates on the work underway at Johns Hopkins. CSP would also play a role in supporting the UDV lawsuit that resulted in the 2006 Supreme Court decision. The Council on Spiritual Practices grew out of Jesse's systematic exploration of the psychedelic literature and the psychedelic community in the Bay Area soon after he moved to San Francisco. In his highly deliberate, slightly obsessive, and scrupulously polite way, Jesse contacted the region's numerous psychedelic elders, the rich cast of characters who had been deeply involved in research and therapy in the years before most of the drugs were banned in 1970, with the passing of the Controlled Substances Act and the classification of LSD and psilocybin as Schedule I substances with a high potential for abuse and no recognized medical use. There was James Fadiman, the Stanford-trained psychologist who had done pioneering research on psychedelics and problem-solving at the International Foundation for Advanced Study in Menlo Park until the FDA halted the group's work in 1966. In the early 1960s, there was at least as much psychedelic research going on around Stanford as there was at Harvard. It just didn't have a character of the wattage of a Timothy Leary out talking about it. Then there was Fadiman's colleague at the Institute, Myron Stolaroff, a prominent Silicon Valley electrical engineer who worked as a senior executive at Ampex, the magnetic recording equipment maker, until an LSD trip inspired him to give up engineering, much like Bob Jesse, for a career as a psychedelic researcher and therapist. Jesse also found his way into the inner circle of Sasha and Ann Shulgin, legendary Bay Area figures who held weekly dinners for a community of therapists, scientists, and others interested in psychedelics. Sasha Shulgin, who died in 2014, was a brilliant chemist who held a DEA license, allowing him to synthesize novel psychedelic compounds, which he did in prodigious numbers. He was also one of the first to synthesize MDMA since it had been patented by Merck in 1912 and forgotten. Recognizing its psychoactive properties, he introduced the so-called empathogen to the Bay Area's psychotherapy community. Only later did it become the club drug known as ecstasy. Jesse also befriended Houston Smith, the scholar of comparative religion, whose mind had been open to the spiritual potential of psychedelics when, as an instructor lecturer at MIT in 1962, he served as a volunteer in the Good Friday experiment, from which he came away convinced that a mystical experience occasioned by a drug was no different from any other kind. By way of these elders and his own reading, Jesse began unearthing the rich body of first-wave psychedelic research, much of which had been lost to science. He learned that there had been more than 1,000 scientific papers on psychedelic drug therapy before 1965, involving more than 40,000 research subjects. Beginning in the 1950s and continuing into the early 1970s, psychedelic compounds had been used to treat a variety of conditions, including alcoholism, depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and anxiety at the end of life, frequently with impressive results. But few of the studies were well controlled by modern standards, and some of them were compromised by the enthusiasm of the researchers involved. Of even keener interest to Bob Jesse was the early research exploring the potential of psychedelics to contribute to what, in a striking phrase, he calls the betterment of well people. There had been studies of healthy normals, of artistic and scientific creativity and spirituality. The most famous of these was the Good Friday or Marsh Chapel experiment, conducted in 1962 by Walter Pahnke, a psychiatrist and minister working on a PhD dissertation at Harvard under Timothy Leary. In this double-blind experiment, 20 divinity students received a capsule of white powder during a Good Friday service at Marsh Chapel on the Boston University campus, 10 of them containing psilocybin, 10 an active placebo, in this case niacin, which creates a tingling sensation. 8 of the 10 students receiving psilocybin reported a powerful mystical experience, while only one in the control group did. Telling them apart was not difficult, rendering the double-blind a somewhat hollow conceit. Those on the placebo sat sedately in their pews while the others lay down or wandered about the chapel muttering things like, "God is everywhere," and "Oh, the glory." Pahnke concluded that the experiences of those who received the psilocybin were, quote, indistinguishable from, if not identical with, the classic mystical experiences reported in the literature. Houston Smith agreed. "Until the Good Friday experiment," he told an interviewer in 1996, "I had had no direct personal encounter with God." In 1986, Rick Doblin conducted a follow-up study of the Good Friday experiment in which he tracked down and interviewed all but one of the divinity students who received psilocybin at Marsh Chapel. Most reported that the experience had reshaped their lives and work in profound and enduring ways. However, Doblin found serious flaws in Pahnke's published account. Pahnke had failed to mention that several subjects had struggled with acute anxiety during their experience. One had to be restrained and given an injection of Thorazine, a powerful antipsychotic, after he fled from the chapel and headed down Commonwealth Avenue, convinced he'd been chosen to announce the news of the coming of the Messiah. In this and a second review of another Timothy Leary's supervised experiment, of recidivism at Concord State Prison, Doblin had raised troubling questions about the quality of the research done in the Harvard psilocybin project, suggesting that the enthusiasm of the experimenters had tainted the reported results. If this research were going to be revived and taken seriously, Jesse concluded, it would have to be done with considerably more rigor and objectivity. And yet the results of the Good Friday experiment were highly suggestive. And, as Bob Jesse and Roland Griffiths would soon decide, well worth trying to reproduce. Bob Jesse spent the early 1990s excavating the knowledge about psychedelics that had been lost when formal research was halted and informal research went underground. In this, he was a little like those Renaissance scholars who rediscovered the lost world of classical thought in a handful of manuscripts squirreled away in monasteries. However, in this case, considerably less time had elapsed, so the knowledge remained in the brains of people still alive, like James Fadiman and Myron Stolaroff and Willis Harmon, another Bay Area engineer-turned-psychedelic researcher, who merely had to be asked for it, and in scientific papers in libraries and databases, which merely had to be searched. But if there is a modern analogy to the medieval monastery where the world of classical thought was saved from oblivion, a place where the guttering flame of psychedelic knowledge was assiduously fanned during its own dark age, that place would have to be Esalen, the legendary retreat center in Big Sur, California. Perched on a cliff overlooking the Pacific, as if barely clinging to the continent, the Esalen Institute was founded in 1962 and ever since has been a center of gravity for the so-called human potential movement in America, serving as the unofficial capital of the New Age. A great many therapeutic and spiritual modalities were developed and taught here over the years, including the therapeutic and spiritual potential of psychedelics. Beginning in 1973, Stanislav Grof, the Czech emigre psychiatrist who is one of the pioneers of LSD-assisted psychotherapy, served as scholar-in-residence at Esalen, but he had conducted workshops there for years before. Grof, who has guided thousands of LSD sessions, once predicted that psychedelics, quote, would be for psychiatry what the microscope is for biology or the telescope is for astronomy. These tools make it possible to study important processes that under normal circumstances are not available for direct observation. Hundreds came to Esalen to peer through that microscope, often in workshops Grof led for psychotherapists who wanted to incorporate psychedelics in their practices. Many, if not most, of the therapists and guides now doing this work underground learned their craft at the feet of Stan Grof in the big house at Esalen. Whether such work continued at Esalen after LSD was made illegal is uncertain, but it wouldn't be surprising. The place is perched so far out over the edge of the continent as to feel beyond the reach of federal law enforcement. But at least officially, such workshops ended when LSD became illegal. Grof began teaching instead something called holotropic breathwork, a technique for inducing a psychedelic state of consciousness without drugs by means of deep, rapid and rhythmic breathing, usually accompanied by loud drumming. Yet Esalen's role in the history of psychedelics did not end with their prohibition. It became the place where people hoping to bring these molecules back into the culture, whether as an adjunct to therapy or a means of spiritual development, met to plot their campaigns. In January 1994, Bob Jesse managed to get himself invited to one such meeting at Esalen. While helping out with the dishes after a Friday night dinner at the Shulgin's, Jesse learned that a group of therapists and scientists would be gathering in Big Sur to discuss the prospects for reviving psychedelic research. There were signs that the door Washington, D.C. had slammed shut on research in the late 1960s might be opening, if only a crack. Curtis Wright, a new administrator at the FDA, and as it happens, a former student of Roland Griffiths at Hopkins, had signaled that research protocols for psychedelics would be treated like any other, judged on their merits. Testing this new receptivity, a psychiatrist at the University of New Mexico named Rick Strassman had sought and received approval to study the physiological effects of DMT, a powerful psychedelic compound found in many plants. This small trial marked the first federally sanctioned experiment with a psychedelic compound since the 1970s, in retrospect a watershed event. Around the same time, Rick Doblin and Charles Grobe, a psychiatrist at UCLA, had succeeded in persuading the government to approve the first human trial of MDMA. Grobe is one of the first psychiatrists to advocate for the return of psychedelics to psychotherapy. He later conducted the first modern trial of psilocybin for cancer patients. The year before the Esalen gathering, which Grobe and Doblin both attended, David Nichols, a Purdue University chemist and pharmacologist, launched the Hefter Research Institute, named for the German chemist who first identified the mescaline compound in 1897 with the then improbable ambition of funding serious psychedelic science. Hefter has since helped fund many of the modern trials of psilocybin. So there were scattered hopeful signs in the early 1990s that conditions were ripening for a revival of psychedelic research. The tiny community that had sustained such a dream through the Dark Ages began, tentatively, quietly, to organize. Even though Jesse was new to this community and neither a scientist nor a therapist, he asked if he could attend the Esalen meeting and offered to make himself useful, refilling water glasses if that's what it took. Most of the gathering was taken up with discussions of the potential medical applications of psychedelics, as well as the need for basic research on the neuroscience. Jesse was struck by the fact that so little attention was paid to the spiritual potential of these compounds. He left the meeting convinced that, okay, there is room to maneuver here. I was hoping one of these people would pick up the ball and run with it, but they were busy with the other ball. So I made a decision to seek a leave of absence from Oracle. Within a year, Jesse would launch the Council on Spiritual Practices, and within two, the Council would convene its own meeting at Esalen in January 1996 with the aim of opening a second front in the campaign to resurrect psychedelics. Fittingly, the gathering took place in the Maslow Room at Esalen, named for the psychologist whose writings on the hierarchy of human needs underscored the importance of peak experiences in self-actualization. Most of the 15 in attendance were psychedelic elders, therapists and researchers like James Fadiman and Willis Harmon, Mark Kleiman, then a drug policy expert at the Kennedy School and Rick Doblin's thesis tutor there, and religious figures like Houston Smith, Brother David Stendel Rast, and Jeffrey Bronfman, the head of the UDV Church in America and heir to the Seagram's liquor fortune. But Jesse wisely decided to invite an outsider as well, Charles Bob Schuster, who had served both Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush as director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Jesse didn't know Schuster well at all. They had once spoken briefly at a conference. But Jesse came away from the encounter thinking Schuster just might be receptive to an invitation. Exactly why Bob Schuster, a leading figure in the academic establishment undergirding the drug war, would be open to the idea of coming to Esalen to discuss the spiritual potential of psychedelics was a mystery, at least until I had the opportunity to speak to his widow, Chris Ellen Johansson. Johansson, who is also a drug researcher, painted a picture of a man of exceptionally broad interests and deep curiosity. Bob was open-minded to a fault, she told me with a laugh. He would talk to anyone. Like many people in the NIDA community, Schuster well understood that the psychedelics fit awkwardly into the profile of a drug of abuse. Animals given the choice will not self-administer a psychedelic more than once, and the classical psychedelics exhibit remarkably little toxicity. I asked Johnson if Schuster had ever taken a psychedelic himself. Roland Griffiths had told me he thought it was possible. Bob was a jazz musician, Griffiths told me, so I wouldn't be at all surprised. But Johansson said no. He was definitely curious about them, she told me, but I think he was too afraid. We were martini people. I asked if he was a spiritual man. Not really, though I think he would have liked to have been. Jesse, not quite sure what Schuster would make of the meeting, arranged to have Jim Fadiman bunk with him, instructing Fadiman, a psychologist, to check him out. Jesse told me, early the next morning, Jim found me and said, Bob, mission accomplished. You have found a gem of a human being. Schuster thoroughly enjoyed his time at Esalen, according to his wife. He took part in a drumming circle Jesse had arranged. You don't leave Esalen without doing some such thing, and was amazed to discover how easily he could slip into a trance. But Schuster also made some key contributions to the group's deliberations. He warned Jesse off working with MDMA, which he believed was toxic to the brain, and had by then acquired an unsavory reputation as a club drug. He also suggested that psilocybin was a much better candidate for research than LSD, largely for political reasons. Because so many fewer people had heard of it, psilocybin carried none of the political and cultural baggage of LSD. By the end of the meeting, the Esalen group had settled on a short list of objectives, some of them modest, to draft a code of ethics for spiritual guides, and others more ambitious. Quote, to get above board, unimpeachable research done at an institution with investigators beyond reproach, and ideally, do this without any pretext of clinical treatment. We weren't sure that this was possible, Jesse told me, but he and his colleagues believed, quote, it would be a big mistake if medicalization is all that happens. Why a mistake? Because Bob Jesse was ultimately less interested in people's mental problems than with their spiritual well-being, in using entheogens for the betterment of well people. Shortly after the Esalen meeting, Schuster made what would turn out to be his most important contribution, telling Bob Jesse about his old friend Roland Griffiths, whom he described as exactly the investigator beyond reproach Jesse was looking for and, quote, a scientist of the first order. Everything Roland's done, he's devoted himself to completely, Jesse recalls Schuster saying, including his meditation practice. We think it's changed him. Griffiths had shared with Schuster his growing dissatisfaction with science and his deepening interest in the kind of ultimate questions coming up in his meditation practice. Schuster then made the call to Griffiths, telling him about the interesting young man he'd just met at Esalen, explaining that they shared an interest in spirituality and suggesting that they should meet. After an exchange of emails, Jesse flew to Baltimore to have lunch with Griffiths in the cafeteria on the Bayview Medical Campus, inaugurating a series of conversations and meetings that would eventually lead to their collaboration on the 2006 study of psilocybin and mystical experience at Johns Hopkins. But there was still one missing piece of the puzzle and the scientific team. Most of the drug trials Griffiths had run in the past involved baboons and other non-human primates. He had much less clinical experience working with humans and realized he needed a skilled therapist to join the project, a master clinician, as he put it. As it happened, Bob Jesse had met a psychologist at a psychedelic conference a few years before who not only filled the bill but lived in Baltimore. Still more fortuitous, this psychologist, whose name was Bill Richards, probably had more experience guiding psychedelic journeys in the 1960s and 1970s than anyone alive, with the possible exception of Stan Grof, with whom he had once worked. In fact, Bill Richards administered the very last legal dose of psilocybin to an American at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center at Spring Grove State Hospital in the spring of 1977. In the decades since, he had been practicing more conventional psychotherapy out of his home in a leafy Baltimore neighborhood called Windsor Hills, biding his time and waiting patiently for the world to come around so that he might work with psychedelics once again. In the big picture, he told me the first time we met in his home office, these drugs have been around at least 5,000 years, and many times they have surfaced and have been repressed. So this was another cycle. But the mushroom still grows, and eventually this work would come around again, or so I hoped. When he got the call from Bob Jesse in 1998 and met Roland Griffiths shortly thereafter, he couldn't quite believe his good fortune. It was thrilling, he said. Bill Richards, a preternaturally cheerful man in his 70s, is a bridge between the two eras of psychedelic therapy. Walter Pahnke was the best man at his wedding. He worked closely with Stan Grof at Spring Grove and visited Timothy Leary in Millbrook, New York, where Leary landed after his exile from Harvard. Though Richards left the Midwest half a century ago, he's retained the speech patterns of rural Michigan, where he was born in 1940. Richards today sports a white goatee, laughs with an infectious cackle, and ends many of his sentences with a cheerful, upspoken, you know? Richards, who holds graduate degrees in both psychology and divinity, had his first psychedelic experience while a divinity student at Yale in 1963. He was spending the year studying in Germany at the University of Göttingen and found himself drawn to the Department of Psychiatry, where he learned about a research project involving a drug called psilocybin. I had no idea what that was, but two friends of mine had participated and had had interesting experiences. One of them, whose father had been killed in the war, had regressed to childhood to find himself sitting on his father's lap. The other had hallucinations of SS men marching in the street. I had never had a decent hallucination, Richard said with a chuckle, and I was trying to get some insight into my childhood. In those days, I viewed my own mind as a psychological laboratory, so I decided to volunteer. Richard said, this was before the importance of set and setting was understood. I was brought to a basement room, given an injection, and left alone. A recipe for a bad trip, surely, but Richards had precisely the opposite experience. I felt immersed in this incredibly detailed imagery that looked like Islamic architecture with Arabic script, about which I knew nothing. And then I somehow became these exquisitely intricate patterns, losing my usual identity. And all I can say is that the eternal brilliance of mystical consciousness manifested itself. My awareness was flooded with love, beauty, and peace beyond anything I ever had known or imagined to be possible. Awe, glory, and gratitude were the only words that remained relevant. Descriptions of such experiences always sound a little thin, at least when compared with the emotional impact people are trying to convey. For a life-transforming event, the words can seem paltry. When I mentioned this to Richards, he smiled. "You have to imagine a caveman transported into the middle of Manhattan," he says. "He sees buses, cell phones, skyscrapers, airplanes, then zap him back to his cave. What does he say about the experience? It was big. It was impressive. It was loud. He doesn't have the vocabulary for skyscraper, elevator, cell phone. Maybe he has an intuitive sense that there was some sort of significance or order to the scene, but there are words we need that don't yet exist. We've got 5 crayons when we need 50,000 different shades." In the middle of his journey, one of the psychiatric residents stopped by the room to look in on Richards, asking him to sit up so he could test his reflexes. As the resident tapped his patellar tendon with his little rubber hammer, Richards remembers feeling, quote, "compassion for the infancy of science. The researchers had no idea what really was happening in my inner experiential world, of its unspeakable beauty, or of its potential importance for all of us." A few days after the experience, Richards returned to the lab and asked, "What was that drug you gave me? How is it spelled? And the rest of my life is footnotes." Yet after several subsequent psilocybin sessions failed to produce another mystical experience, Richards started to wonder if perhaps he had exaggerated that first trip. Sometime later, Walter Pahnke arrived at the university, fresh from his graduate work with Timothy Leary at Harvard, and the two became friends. It was Richards who gave Pahnke his first psychedelic trip while the two were in Germany. He had apparently never taken LSD or psilocybin at Harvard, thinking it might compromise the objectivity of the Good Friday experiment. Pahnke suggested Richards try one more time, but in a room with soft lighting, plants, and music, and using a higher dose. Once again, Richards had, quote, "an incredibly profound experience. I realized I had not exaggerated the first trip, but in fact had forgotten 80% of it. I have never doubted the validity of these experiences," Richards told me. "This was the realm of mystical consciousness that Shankara was talking about, that Plotinus was writing about, that St. John of the Cross and Meister Eckhart were writing about. It's also what Abraham Maslow was talking about with his peak experiences, though Abe could get there without the drugs." Richards would go on to study psychology under Maslow at Brandeis University. "Abe was a natural Jewish mystic," he told me. "He could just lie down in the backyard and have a mystical experience. Psychedelics are for those of us who aren't so innately gifted." Richards emerged from those first psychedelic explorations in possession of 3 unshakable convictions. The first is that the experience of the sacred, reported both by the great mystics and by people on high-dose psychedelic journeys, is the same experience and is real, that is, not just a figment of the imagination. "You go deep enough and far out enough in consciousness and you will bump into the sacred," he told me. "It's not something we generate. It's something out there waiting to be discovered. And this reliably happens to non-believers as well as believers." Second, that whether occasioned by drugs or other means, these experiences of mystical consciousness are in all likelihood the primal basis of religion. Partly for this reason, Richards believes that psychedelics should be part of a divinity student's education. And third, that consciousness is a property of the universe, not brains. On this question, he holds with Henri Bergson, the French philosopher, who conceived of the human mind as a kind of radio receiver, able to tune in to frequencies of energy and information that exist outside it. "If you wanted to find the blonde who delivered the news last night," Richards offered by way of an analogy, "you wouldn't look for her in the TV set. The television set is, like the human brain, necessary but not sufficient." After Richards finished with his graduate studies in the late 1960s, he found work as a research fellow at the Spring Grove State Hospital outside Baltimore, where a most improbable counterfactual history of psychedelic research was quietly unfolding, far from the noise and glare surrounding Timothy Leary. Indeed, this is a case where the force of the Leary narrative has bent the received history out of shape, such that many of us assume there was no serious psychedelic research before Leary arrived at Harvard and no serious research after he was fired. But until Bill Richards administered psilocybin to his last volunteer in 1977, Springgrove was actively, and without much controversy, conducting an ambitious program of psychedelic research, much of it under grants from the National Institute of Mental Health, with schizophrenics, alcoholics and other addicts, cancer patients struggling with anxiety, religious and mental health professionals, and patients with severe personality disorders. Several hundred patients and volunteers received psychedelic therapy at Springgrove between the early 1960s and the mid-1970s. In many cases, the researchers were getting very good results in well-designed studies that were being regularly published in peer-reviewed journals such as JAMA and the Archives of General Psychiatry. Roland Griffiths is of the opinion that much of this research is suspect, but Richards told me, "These studies weren't as bad as people like Roland might imply." It is remarkable just how much of the work being done today at Hopkins and NYU and other places was prefigured at Springgrove. Indeed, it is hard to find a contemporary experiment with psychedelics that wasn't already done in Maryland in the 1960s or 1970s. At least at the beginning, the Springgrove psychedelic work enjoyed lots of public support. In 1965, CBS News broadcast an admiring hour-long special report on the hospital's work with alcoholics called LSD, the Springgrove Experiment. The response to the program was so positive that the Maryland State Legislature established a multi-million dollar research facility on the campus of the Springgrove State Hospital called the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center. Stan Groff, Walter Pankey, and Bill Richards were hired to help run it, along with several dozen other therapists, psychiatrists, pharmacologists, and support staff. Equally hard to believe today is the fact that, as Richards told me, whenever we hired someone, they would receive a couple of LSD sessions as part of their training to do the work. We had authorization. How else could you be sensitive to what was going on in the mind of the patient? I wish we could do that at Hopkins. The fact that such an ambitious research program continued at Springgrove well into the 1970s suggests the story of the suppression of psychedelic research is a little more complicated than the conventional narrative would indicate. While it is true that some research projects, such as Jim Fadiman's creativity trials in Palo Alto, received orders from Washington to stop, other projects on long-term grants were allowed to continue until the money ran out, as it eventually did. Rather than shut down all the research, as many in the psychedelic community believe happened, the government simply made it more difficult to get approvals, and funding gradually dried up. As time went on, researchers found that on top of all the bureaucratic and financial hurdles, they also had to deal with the Snicker test. How would your colleagues react when you told them you were running experiments with LSD? By the mid-1970s, psychedelics had become something of a scientific embarrassment. Not because they were a failure, but because they had become identified with the counterculture and with disgraced scientists such as Timothy Leary. But there was nothing embarrassing about psychedelic research at Springgrove in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Then and there, it looked like the future. We thought this was the most incredible frontier in psychiatry, Richards recalls. We would all sit around the conference table talking about how we were going to train the hundreds, if not thousands, of therapists that would be needed to do this work. And look, we're having the same conversation again today. There were international conferences on psychedelic research, and we had colleagues throughout Europe doing similar work. The field was taking off, but in the end, the societal forces were stronger than we were. In 1971, Richard Nixon declared Timothy Leary, a washed-up psychology professor, the most dangerous man in America. Psychedelics were nourishing the counterculture, and the counterculture was sapping the willingness of America's young to fight. The Nixon administration sought to blunt the counterculture by attacking its neurochemical infrastructure. Was the suppression of psychedelic research inevitable? Many of the researchers I interviewed feel that it might have been avoided had the drugs not leapt the laboratory walls, a contingency that, fairly or not, most of them blame squarely on the antics, misbehavior, and evangelism of Timothy Leary. Stanislav Grof believes that psychedelics loosed quote, the Dionysian element on 1960s America, posing a threat to the country's Puritan values that was bound to be repulsed. He told me he also thinks the same thing could happen again. Roland Griffiths points out that ours is not the first culture to feel threatened by psychedelics. The reason R. Gordon Wasson had to rediscover magic mushrooms in Mexico was that the Spanish had suppressed them so effectively, deeming them dangerous instruments of paganism. That says something important about how reluctant cultures are to expose themselves to the changes these kinds of compounds can occasion, he told me the first time we met. There is so much authority that comes out of the primary mystical experience that it can be threatening to existing hierarchical structures. By the mid-1970s, the LSD work at Spring Grove, much of which was state-funded, had become a political hot potato in Annapolis. In 1975, the Rockefeller Commission investigating the CIA disclosed that the agency had also been running LSD experiments in Maryland at Fort Detrick as part of a mind control project called MKUltra. An internal memo the commission released concisely set forth the agency's objective. Can we get control of an individual to the point where he will do our bidding against his will and even against fundamental laws of nature such as self-preservation? It was revealed that the CIA was dosing both government employees and civilians without their knowledge. At least one person had died. The news that Maryland taxpayers were also supporting research with LSD promptly blew up into a scandal, and pressure to close down psychedelic research at Spring Grove became irresistible. Pretty soon, it was just me and two secretaries, Richards recalls, and then it was over. Today, Roland Griffiths, who would pick up the thread of research that was dropped when the work at Spring Grove ended, marvels at the fact that the first wave of psychedelic research, promising as it was, would end for reasons having nothing to do with science. We ended up demonizing these compounds, he told me. Can you think of another area of science thought to be so dangerous and taboo that all research gets shut down for decades? It's unprecedented in modern science. So too, perhaps, is the sheer amount of scientific knowledge that was simply erased. In 1998, Griffiths, Jesse, and Richards began designing a pilot study loosely based on the Good Friday experiment. It wasn't a psychotherapy study, Richards points out. It was a study designed to determine whether psilocybin can elicit a transcendental experience. That we were able to obtain permission to give it to healthy normals is a tribute to Roland's long history of commanding respect, both at Hopkins and in Washington. In 1999, the protocol was approved, but only after wending its way through five layers of review at Hopkins, as well as the FDA and the DEA. Many of Griffith's Hopkins colleagues were skeptical of the proposal, worried psychedelic research might jeopardize federal funding. One told me there were, quote, people in the Department of Psychiatry and the broader institution who questioned the work, because this class of compounds carries a lot of baggage from the 60s. We had faith that the people on all these committees would be good scientists, Richards told me. And with luck, maybe a few of them had tried mushrooms in college. Roland Griffiths became the principal investigator of the trial, Bill Richards became the clinical director, and Bob Jesse continued to work behind the scenes. I can vividly remember the first session I ran after that long 22-year hiatus, Richards recalled. He and I were together in the session room at Hopkins. I was sitting on the couch where the volunteers lie down during their journeys, and Richards was in the chair where he has now sat and guided more than 100 psilocybin journeys since 1999. The room felt more like a den or living room than a room in a laboratory, with a plush sofa, vaguely spiritual paintings on the wall, a sculpture of the Buddha on a side table, and shelves holding a giant stone mushroom and various other non-denominational spiritual artifacts, as well as the small chalice in which the volunteers receive their pills. This guy is lying on the couch right there where you are, with tears streaming down his face, and I'm thinking, how absolutely beautiful and meaningful this experience is. How sacred. How can this ever have been illegal? It's as if we made entering Gothic cathedrals illegal, or museums, or sunsets. I honestly never knew if this would happen again in my lifetime. And look at where we are now. The work at Hopkins has been going on now for 15 years, 5 years longer than Spring Grove. In 1999, an odd but intriguing advertisement began appearing in weeklies in the Baltimore and Washington, D.C. area under the headline, "Interested in the Spiritual Life?" University research with entheogens, roughly God-evoking substances such as peyote and sacred mushrooms, has returned. The field of study includes pharmacology, psychology, creativity enhancement, and spirituality. To explore the possibility of participating in confidential entheogen research projects, call 1-888-585-8870 toll-free, www.csp.org.